It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists. With your host, Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations.
And we are doing just that today via Zoom because it is 2020. We still can't get into our studios, but we're gathering our guests in a different way because we still have a wonderful conversation to share with all of you today. And we're going to be talking about the art and science of print journalism and reporting the news. And Mark, why don't you introduce our guest to everyone and let us know what we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, we're really excited. We've been trying to have this, I think, since March of 2020. And we have with us award-winning journalist Sarah Bowman. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, happy to be here.
Hi, Sarah.
And we also have award-winning journalist Emily Hopkins. Hi, Emily.
Hi, thank you.
And both currently work as investigative journalists as well as regular journalists and anything they want at IndyStar in the way of journalism. I love, by the way, just reading your articles. You guys really do journalism the way it should be done, and it's really, really impressive. We, though, are concerned right now with how does journalism move forward during a pandemic when there is so much opportunity for, misinformation to happen.
Yeah,
deadlines still remain, and they're still so important. I mean, nothing has slowed down for you guys, that's for sure. The rest of the world maybe, but not for you.
No, I think quite the opposite. Deadlines have gotten actually even shortened. We, of course, put out a newspaper every day, but I have gotten to the point where I apologize to people I'm reaching out to, and I say, I'm sorry, but the deadline is ASAP because we are trying to get the information up as fast as possible. And when you talk about misinformation, I think that's one way that we're, I think, trying to combat it is to get the most accurate information out first, so that, readers, that's what they see first. They know that the IndyStar has put that out. They know they can trust that, and they don't see maybe something else and that changes their mind after that. So it's been very hectic, very, very busy. And I just have to applaud all of my colleagues for all the work they've been putting in, especially our health reporter, Sherry Rudowski, who's put out an incredible amount of journalism this year.
Sarah?
Well, yeah, because suddenly everybody's beat became COVID when this happened.
Yeah,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Sarah, you especially had to blend a little bit of your environmental journalism with COVID at some points, right?
Yeah, I mean, when this pandemic started, you really could, I mean, no beat, when we think about our traditional beats, but every aspect of everyone's lives was touched by this, whether it was the actual health reporting of it and what this disease meant for our health. But I mean, you look at education and what this meant for our schools. You look at business and what this meant for all of these businesses and restaurants that were having to close. And you even saw that with the environment, which is the beat that I focus on and primarily cover. And, there were even kind of cross sections or intersections there. Arguably good with people staying home a lot more with the pandemic. We saw actually drops in air emissions and some pollution, which is a good thing. But then there also was some concerns with various agencies saying they were going to be relaxing enforcement of different industries and things like that because of the pandemic. So, to echo and piggyback on what Emily said, if anything, journalism in general and deadlines and all these things just got, you know, quicker, and things became so much more important to be reporting on these types of topics right now, just in the midst of a public health crisis, and finding that there's always the balance between how quickly you can get something out there, but also wanting to make sure it's the most accurate thing. But that was incredibly important right now when, you know, people are making real decisions that directly impact their health based on the information that is out there. And obviously we're trying to get that information out there in a way, in case other information is out there that is wrong, we want to make sure that we're getting that information out there in a way that people can count on it and trust it.
Yeah, and I would guess...
Have you found...
Go ahead, Jill.
Go ahead, Mark.
I would guess that you had, during this time, one of the concerns I have, nationally, internationally, about environment and some of the things both of you report on, is that the story is COVID. And so things may almost intentionally by some people be under the radar, thinking that nobody's going to detect it or report on it. You know, I mean, there might be, like you said, a laxity in regulation or a dumping or something where somebody's using that fact that the media is overwhelmed with health reporting. Do you find that to be true?
I would say that there's probably definitely some truth into that. I think that there's no way that you can look at this moment and the amount of resources being put into trying to find out new information about this virus and how it's spreading and who it's affecting. I think that there absolutely are people taking advantage of that. And I think that you can see that a lot in the, whenever something gets pushed through, or when you look at the people who are taking advantage of the money that's being doled out by the government. I think people are just saying, oh, there's too much going on. But I would also say it's important to look at the inverse of that. And immediately as governors declared these states of emergency, one thing that almost all, if not all, did was to relax requirements around public records requests. So in Indiana, we have a pretty, I would call it, I don't think that there aren't many strong public records laws, but I would still call ours pretty weak. Because there's no real requirements around delivering those records. The requirement to deliver them is within a reasonable time after you've requested whatever you've requested. The only timeline requirement is that the government agency has to acknowledge the request. That's literally the only thing that's required of them by law. So that's one thing that was lifted through these actions around emergency declarations and all of these other ways that we relax different regulations because it was an emergency. So the one thing that was making agencies required to respond, that was thrown out the window immediately. And I would say that even just in the behavior of agencies, as you've been trying to file public records, their attitude has been that this is an emergency, and their energy is much better spent trying to deal with a health crisis and not fulfill some frivolous public records request from a journalist who just wants to stir up trouble. And so I have been on my soapbox a lot about this because I've been filing and getting denied a lot from different agencies. And I think that it's actually the complete opposite. A public emergency, a crisis, is actually the most important time for transparency, and it's part of your response to that crisis. It should be part of the government's response to that crisis. It helps to instill trust in the people who are affected by the crisis, who may be affected by the crisis. It helps people when mistakes are made, it helps those mistakes get corrected faster. All of these things happen because of transparency. And so when you fight against that transparency, you are not doing something in service of the crisis because you think your efforts are better served doing this other thing over here. You basically, I think you hinder the response. But that is clearly not the point of view of the agencies that I have requested information from. And I think that even in a the normal times, they would view public records as sort of an appendage rather than a core mission that should be at the center of any department. And you should have someone who is dedicated to records, a records custodian, not just the person who does communications. You need someone who has, you know, you need someone dedicated to that. If you have that person, that's one huge step towards transparency and actually fulfilling the promise of democracy and all that stuff. So as you can tell, like, very much on my soapbox about this because I believe in it so much. But yeah, so I think that it's been difficult because, in short, I think that because the coronavirus pandemic has caused so many crises and emergencies that everyone thinks that transparency is a luxury rather than a part of the response.
Yeah, and I've so had, you,
go ahead, Sarah.
Oh, I was just going to say I've had similar experiences. I mean, there were some records requests that I filed at the end of last year. I mean, several months before the pandemic started, and a few months ago, I reached out to check in on the status of the request. I hadn't heard anything in a while, and you know, the response that I got was that, you know, staff is essentially being pulled in a lot of different directions right now, and you know, their access to records is limited, which to some extent I understand, because if some of these records are in the office and folks are working from home, so I understand that there's some legitimacy to that. But I also think in some regards, again, the pandemic is being used in a way to kind of delay responding to those or delaying answering questions and transparency. And I mean, I've also heard from some folks that they feel some local governments have been, in a way, using the pandemic to kind of limit public input, you know, having smaller meetings or having virtual meetings that they don't really get information out there on, or that sort of thing, to limit public input on kind of what are some controversial projects or topics or that sort of thing. And in some regards, some of these things may be happening intentionally, you know, these agencies or folks, whoever it may be, using it. In some regards, it may just be that they really do think, oh, all of our focus needs to be on this public health crisis. And I think that is part of our job to say, yes, this is incredibly important, but we also need to remember that there are these other things going on, you know, that continue to happen every day, even with this public health crisis going on. And so even if they're not kind of diverting their attentions intentionally, we need to intentionally remind them, hey, you need to not forget about this. This is incredibly important to so many people out there who are affected by this, you know, who perhaps live next to a polluting facility, and you need, yeah, you know, to not lax your monitoring of them or your inspections of them and that sort of thing.
Right. Or even, so, I would say, yeah, like, we've been fighting for a long time to get zip code level data of COVID cases because we wanted to look and see, first of all, where are the most cases? And also, like, are there disparities among neighborhoods? And, you know, since we know there was a disparity, but we don't really have any more drilled down understanding of that disparity. And they finally did release it, and we found what people have been finding across the country, which is that people of color in lower income neighborhoods have more cases. But they, you know, the agency said, you know, we haven't analyzed the data in this way, so we don't have to give it to you. And it just became very frustrating because we just felt like that would be something that everyone would want, the agency included. We would want to have this data so that you could have it for your response. And so, in that way, it's been frustrating because even information that you would think that the agencies could use part of their response, they've been hesitant to release it. Or, you know, there's a level of just chaos in their agency that they haven't been proactively seeking to collect it. And that just shows, I think, a lack of leadership on the part of the agency that they should have made it a priority to begin with.
Right. And I think as the pandemic continues, it has changed a little bit. I agree with you on all those points too. At the beginning, it was such a it was an easy way for people to not deal with topics that they really should have been dealing with, and they could get by with it. But now things are, we've got a little bit more of a path. We know where things are going. They're going to have to come up with some answers and some things. And that makes you as journalists, that makes you have to double down even more on your investigative skills to not let them lose track of stories that you've probably been already working months ahead of time on to get out there and present to the public. And it doesn't make that story any less important now. And so in a way you're kind of like, you're fighting another battle as well.
Yeah.
The initial battle and then the battle again to get it back out there with the proper information.
I do have kind of a funny example if you'll let me. I think, I won't go too far in the story, but in March we release an investigation into Indiana's public hospitals and nursing homes or I should say county hospitals. And we had a number of records requests out to those hospitals that they had denied. And we in fact escalated the issue up to the public access counselor. And then, the pandemic arrived, and we got a request that was ultimately granted by the public access counselor from the hospital's council to basically give them an extension until the end of May. This was in March, so the end of May to give them an answer. And we reflected about the fact that we understand that the hospital administrators will probably be very busy responding to this crisis. They have a lot of decision making to do. But we couldn't figure out how the lawyer would be involved at that level. The lawyer is not going to be deciding what rooms get made into ICU beds. And frankly, he's not even a part of these organizations. He's an external counsel that's been hired, to represent these people in these fights. So I think it goes to show you that, like, that's an example where I think you probably could justify it if I knew a little bit more. But you would really have to do some convincing to tell me that that wasn't just a way to get an extension during a crisis.
Yeah, and you would think during it that getting the information so that they could operate on it, right? You're asking for information that they need to know.
Mm-hmm.
You would think that would still be a priority. You know, they might not be collecting their water data, but, and I could get that. But if it's about health in nursing homes or in hospitals, you'd think that'd be the very thing that they would be collecting data and being current on.
Well, I think something else that everybody's learned through this pandemic as time has gone on as well, from lawyers to arts and culture organizations to small businesses, is at the beginning, everybody was really worried about not having the right answer and looking bad and messing up. And now we've learned that now is the best time. If you are going to mess up or make a huge mistake, now is the best time to admit to it, because mm-hmm. everything has literally been turned upside down. Now, coming out of this is the time to completely rearrange whatever plan, organization, business, museum model that you might have had in the past, because it's going to have to be different. And so hopefully that will give people more opportunity to be more open and not try to cover up as much as they probably were in the past.
You would hope, but I am doubtful.
habits that have been developed over time die slowly.
Die hard, yeah.
And they may react a little bit, but I think everybody thinks this is so short term. And it may or may not be. We may be in for a little bit longer. Even I think if there's a vaccine, it'll be just like with the flu, there'll still be people that will contract it. Mm-hmm. And that is still scary with this one, because this is a much scarier thing than the flu. Mm-hmm. One of the things I thought was interesting, and I get frustrated, I've almost wanted to do my own analysis, is the CDC put out a bunch of data on graphs, but they varied the graph numbers on every one of them by state. And the New York Times just reprinted it, all of them on one page on a Sunday New York Times. And it's not exactly their fault, although the public doesn't know to look and see. Mm-hmm. And so you can't compare a state to a state by looking at the graph, because the state of Indiana looked as big as New York, but it's not. It doesn't have the same population. But if you looked at the numbers in the graph on the side, So that, I think that's part of why investigative reporting is also important, is helping people, because our public doesn't not sometimes know what to look for in basic literacy of how to read a graph.
Yeah, I mean, graphics and visualizations and those sorts of things, and I know Emily obviously does a ton with data, so she can, I'm sure, fill in after me with a lot more information and sounding much more knowledgeable. But I mean, graphics and visualizations can be such a key and helpful tool in explaining what are otherwise might be kind of complicated topics, or just helping to really take a lot of numbers and different data points and kind of put it into a way that helps people understand, especially dealing with whether it's health topics or the environment, a lot of things that, again, can sometimes be quite complex, science heavy. But the key is that they need to be well thought through graphics and visualizations. And I know that those are conversations that, you know, Emily and I have had together on stories that we've worked on, as well as with some of our colleagues in the newsroom. I mean, I even just had a graphic for a story I was working on recently, and I had an almost hour-long conversation with one of my colleagues of how do we display this information? Because if we do it this way, it gives off this impression, which isn't entirely accurate. But then if we do it this way, it's a simpler way, but it doesn't can give you all the context that you need. And so those are such critical conversations to be having, because during this time, they can really help break down this issue and help folks understand. I mean, looking at a graph, many people, they understand that. They understand what it means. But if it's not done in a smart way, it can actually create kind of more confusion.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say like a really good example of this is, and that we're currently, and I think the media as an industry, I think the journalism industry is struggling with how to explain this effectively. And it may just be that it's a concept that just is over people's heads, but is the difference in testing from March to today. And so we have so many more tests that are being done every day. And so we have more cases that are being captured. If you remember back in March and April, it was really hard to get a test. Now you can go and walk up to a clinic and get one. So I think what I see, you know, if you are, if you ever tune into the governor's press conferences on Wednesday, you can watch some very wild claims in the comments just kind of roll by. And one of them is that, you know, we have more cases because there's more testing. The end of story. It's not increasing. Of course, we know that's why the state of Indiana and other places as well, this is such an emphasis on the testing rate. And that's because if you have, if you're testing more people and you're still getting a higher rate of positives, that means that's bad. That means that there's probably more people who are getting infected. But I think people are having a hard time understanding beyond the, and then even before that, when numbers were going up, I think there was some fear about the numbers going up, but then that actually was because we were doing more testing and the increase was attributable to the increase in testing. So it's this kind of like flip thing that you have to do. It's like, well, that then was attributable to this factor. Now it's no longer attributed to that factor. And you have all these complexities that really goes to show you how much context is important around data. And how you can't just throw the numbers out there and hope people understand, or because people will ultimately draw their own conclusions for that. So you kind of have to walk the people through all of the ways that the numbers matter and the caveats that are associated with them.
And now also when it comes to the visual presentation, you don't just have the good old days of where it was a paper that people looked at. You have to take into how are they seeing it, on what kind of device are they seeing it, and what's going to be presented to them as well. And that's mm-hmm. a whole nother aspect mm-hmm. of your job. We'll dig into that a little bit too. We're going to take a short break. We're speaking with journalists Emily Hopkins and Sarah Bowman. We're talking about the art and science of investigative reporting. We'll take a break and be back with more of our conversation. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR The Diamond.
We are strong, we are resilient, and we will get through this together. But these are stressful times, and it's important to also practice good self-care. It's normal to feel overwhelmed, anxious, or afraid, but there is hope. Reach out to someone, connect with your friends, stay in touch with your community, and know that you are not alone. Learn more at wearebroadcasters.com/hope. Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
I'm back. I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling. And today we're talking about the challenges and successes of investigative reporting with award-winning journalists Sarah Bowman and Emily Hopkins. And when we left our first segment, I was really interested in asking, what is investigative reporting?
Well, that's a great question. I think that it's a very fluid definition. I think that in some ways, some people would say that all journalism should be investigative. And even if that's not every story is an investigative piece, that every reporter should be involved in doing some kind of investigative reporting. If you're an arts reporter, that means you should be investigating the people who have power in the arts community. If you, I think that goes for sports reporting. Obviously, I think IndyStar learned, that sports has a lot of things wrong with it. So, I think investigative reporting is when you bring about a revelation that is about the system that demonstrates how the system isn't working and is potentially hurting people. So I think that's my personal definition, is that you are exposing something, even if it's not something that's secret, but you're calling something for what it is. And that is, it could be corrupt. It could be harmful. It could unjust. It could be a variety of like descriptors like that. But that's sort of the way I define it and approach my work, I guess. That's all I would say.
And I would agree a lot with what Emily said. And one of the things that she hit on the head, which I was going to mention as well, is that, yes, there are certain reporters like Emily and myself, we find ourselves on the investigative team at the IndyStar, but that doesn't mean that others can't do investigative work. I mean, I think for us being on the investigative team, it more so is kind of... I specifically cover the environment, but some of my colleagues on the team, they kind of have license to, they don't have a specific topic that they have to look at. So there's a little bit of flexibility and freedom there. And it also just affords us a bit more time, because often investigative work takes a bit more time to really dig into something and get the documents. But that doesn't mean that everyone can't be and shouldn't be doing this type of work. And I really see investigative work as similar to what Emily was saying, holding, those in power to account, really just making sure that what they're doing is in the public's best interest and they're serving and doing the things, obviously as they should be. And investigative work can sometimes go to, you know, the level of uncovering and or exposing, as Emily said, corruption or something like that. But it could also mean nothing illegal is necessarily happening, but it's still harming people. I mean, there could be a loophole, you know, within the system that is perfectly legal, but it's still causing harm. Another thing that Emily said, and kind of an example that I often think of, is, for example, with IndyStar's coverage of the gymnastics scandal, which, you know, is before my time, but, you know, it started with looking at one, you know, one coach or one doctor. It kind of started small, and then it went to, no, there are multiple, you know, people here that are involved in this. And then it went to that, the larger system of, and USA Gymnastics knew about this and let it happen, you know, covered it up. And so I think it's also continuing to always, like Emily said, go to that system of what is letting or allowing this to happen, you know, kind of taking it to that highest level, and then, you know, holding that to account at that highest level.
Being known as investigative reporters, does that help or hinder your ability to cultivate sources when it comes to stories?
I would say it helped. I think my experience, I feel like honestly, when I was on the team with Sarah, and I think that the bigger issue with developing sources was actually that we had environment in our title. Because, you know, I think that everyone assumes that you have an agenda or whatever. And we've talked about this, Sarah, like we could have very easily have been called natural resource reporters, because I did a lot of reporting on energy use, you know, what is the coal industry doing? Like what is ag doing? You know, we were doing these different, you know, I did soil health stories, you know, that's a resource, you know, as much as it's the environment. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I got more reaction out of that than I do the investigative reporter. I think people gravitate towards that title because they believe that they can trust you because you're going to protect them. So I do think that they don't think that their story is going to be flipped for some cheap clicks or whatever. Not that we do that with anything, but like, no. But I think they feel confident.
But I think, you know, you both have to operate a little bit like our friends in the science world, and that you would run a danger of going after something you think is there, which is a preconceived, or you're putting your own bias on there. And so you do have to be careful about being open to where the story takes you. In other words, there's a question, there's something that's making you curious, but I would think as a reporter, you have to be very, very delicate about, you know, confirmation bias. In other words, I wanna say this industry is really bad, so I'm gonna find everything that's really bad. That would be a real danger, I would think.
I mean, I think that happens. I mean, that certainly was something that Emily and I often had to check ourselves, you know, in terms of environmental coverage. But I think that's the case investigative reporting in general, because you kind of set out with this, you know, idea of whether it's come from a tip or, you know, or you just kind of through doing a daily story, you kind of say, hey, I wonder if there's more here, you know, if there's something going on here. But you kind of set out with this thesis, if you will, you know, and then similar to in scientific research, you know, then either work to prove or disprove said thesis. But you do have to be careful because, again, as with research, you know, you can always find some study out there to tell you what you want to hear, you know, support what you think is the situation. You need to, because you could very easily talk to just the people who are going to tell you what you want or that sort of thing. So you always need to, like you were saying, Mark, I mean, really try and be conscious of that and be making sure you're doing well-rounded reporting and be asking yourself, what are the holes to this story? You know, so you can try and fill them and plug them ahead of time. And possibly in doing so, like you said, it could actually lead you down a different path and you find out, hey, the story isn't exactly what I thought. It's actually more over here. But so I think, and I mean, and that's one of the things with investigative reporting. Also, I think often you find, I mean, certainly there, you do have an individual, you know, individuals who will report a story all by themselves. But oftentimes I think it's helpful that investigative reporting is done in that team environment, because it's really helpful to have those conversations, whether it's with your fellow reporters, with your editor, you know, sometimes even with the photographers or those sorts of folks who are working on these stories with you, because everyone's going to bring their different perspective to it. And everyone's going to say, well, in this conversation I had, or in my previous knowledge, you know, X, Y, Z, and it helps you have that more well-rounded picture in reporting out these stories.
That's what I was going to ask about too, is that support system. How important is having that support system to be able to do the story that you want to do or change it if it suddenly goes a different direction?
I mean, absolutely crucial, because I am kept up at night the day before a story publishes. It happened this week and it was not even an investigation. It was just off of the news. I kept thinking, well, did I slice this the wrong way? Am I going to wake up and realize that I completely like read the data wrong? You know, and I think that, when you're doing that larger project, I mean, like, I'm constantly having conversations with my team.
Emily and I were saying, because we actually chatted yesterday briefly on the phone, and we were saying, because we sit next to each other in the office, but obviously that, you know, was months and months and months ago. What's an office?
What's an office?
And that's one of the things that's been hard about the pandemic in terms of kind of being with colleagues, because obviously when you're in the office, you just chat, hey, how are you doing? And you catch up. Whereas now it's like every exchange with a colleague is so transactional. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of miss that part of it. So Emily and I yesterday were like, it'll be so nice to just actually get to like talk together.
I know. I was like, we will legitimately be catching up because we haven't talked in a while.
Yeah, I think it's really hard. It's really hard on me because the way I run the nonprofit we have is all through individual conversations and transactions. We might just have a conversation. What do you do? What do I do? And just talk in general. But then later when I'm thinking of, oh, I want to do something, you know, design an exhibit on this, or I want to, you know, do a program on this, then I go, oh, I know Emily might be who I should contact. And so I don't get that part. It's just exactly what you said, Sarah. I'm going drilling right to the point. Mm-hmm. Always. The only thing I'm getting that really does help is these, because I'm meeting people that we have a regular conversation. But I agree, it is hard.
That basically is like that. I'm just like sending them information, bits and bobs, like all the time. And those, like, we'll have long flowing conversations about like, does this really mean what we think it means? And I think the key is when you get to a point where you get into like the circular talk, where you go all the way around to the beginning and you say, oh yeah, I know I am right. You go doubt, wait a second, I have the evidence and I'm right. This is the right thing. And I think that's when a sign that you're actually good to go. And then the other component is that we have a lawyer look over the really, really touchy stuff. Like we have that protection. I think that helps a lot. But yeah, I mean, we're talking about the art and science of investigative reporting. The art is, I mean, like, let's remember, like, this is writing. This is very much a creative industry, and we're
telling a story.
Information. Yeah, this is storytelling. So, you know, it is always art, you know, needs community. And I think that's the same for investigative reporting, even if there is a little bit more science involved. It's really important to have a supportive community around you while you're trying to create.
Yeah, and your type of writing is so different too, in that you've got an audience who's going to choose how long they're going to give you. on a particular thing. So there's a lot of you that you guys have to learn to deliver a lot of the key stuff up front and then unpack it, you know, as you go deeper. It's not unlike, by the way, what I used to do in museum labeling. In other words, when I worked in museums, people don't want to read a whole column of text, but some people want all that information, but you had to figure out how to create in that label copy a hierarchy of information that gave the scan reader just enough and the other. And that, I'm sure it has to be frustrating for both of you because you don't write the headlines. And occasionally those headlines can be totally different than actually the story.
We actually do write the headlines a lot of the time.
You do?
I think 90% of the time we're writing the headlines. We get
input. That's a change.
Yeah, we get a lot of input from the people who are on that on the production team. But Sarah, go ahead.
I was going to say, especially on, you know, investigative type of pieces, we do have a lot of say in writing the headlines because, you know, one wrong word there could really make a whole world's difference. But yeah, I mean, writing those stories certainly is, it is a different type of writing, similar to what we were talking about with the graphics and the visualizations. I mean, because how you tell that story, it's not in a way of trying to sensationalize anything, or it's nothing about that. It's how do you take all of this information that you have and put context to it and present it in a way that will make the most sense to people, that they will be able to understand it. And that top section, you know, the very beginning of the story, I don't know about you, Emily, but for me, that is always one of the hardest parts of the story to write, because how do you condense what is such a long story with all of this information into potentially, you know, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 paragraphs? Because if it was easy to do that, you wouldn't need the whole rest of the story to explain what's going on. So, you know, how you kind of condense that at the beginning to let people know, hey, this is what the story is about, but not leave them so confused or actually, you know, because you're trying to kind of pare it down so much.
Yeah.
I feel like it's always tricky for me, at least.
But I'm sure you guys have had to make compromises because of that, of all the ways that they want you to deliver your news now with all the different styles of social media, how that's become so important to get the tweet out about it, get the Instagram out about it, get the print and get the web and the digital. How do you navigate that? Just, you know, choosing what goes where being able to do it.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee. Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
So I think, like, no one is required to, like, Instagram, for example, but some people do that with their job because it helps them keep an audience. And so in this, you know, this day and age of our industry, you know, every single journalist has a little bit of a following, and it's not quite as voicey as I think some online publications have gotten, or maybe a freelancer would be necessarily, but we do have, like, I think we do use those platforms to make sure our audience knows about the things that we're creating, and our audiences follow us because they're interested in what we're creating and what we're writing and producing. So I, like, for example, I learned that, like, I don't like tweeting a ton doesn't give me a return on investment. Some people, it does. It doesn't give me a return on investment. So I very strategically use my Twitter. You know, I make sure I'm using it regularly, that I'm putting stuff out there, that I'm part of people's feeds, but I am not, you know, I'm not in there a lot. I don't Instagram for my job. I Facebook very rarely. Frankly, I've got more people who I'm like, who follow me on Facebook that are from Boston or upstate New York, which is where I'm from, than Indiana at this point, because I just don't find that it's been as useful for me. I still use Facebook to find sources. I still use, you know, Twitter to reach out to people. But those are the things that we're sort of more focused on leveraging in a smart, I guess, work smarter, not harder in that case. I think we've learned that just blasting it out there doesn't necessarily work.
Yeah. And I think, like Emily was saying, it's an opportunity, and between, for example, Twitter and Facebook and, you know, those different social medias, you're reaching often different audiences. I mean, there certainly is some overlap, but I mean, there are some people who are on Facebook, but they don't have a Twitter, or, you know, they're really active on Twitter, following it all the time, you know, and Facebook is kind of for friends and that sort of thing. So, I mean, different people interact with these social media outlets in different ways as well. And so that's why, you know, it's important to kind of post and get our information and this, what we're working on and those sorts of things out there. And they also can be really effective tools for source building.
Oh, yeah.
You know, whether it's we post something ahead of time of a, like, hey, we're working on this kind, this story. You know, if any of you have experiences, let us know. Or sometimes we post a story that has just published and, you know, then we get someone who reaches out to us and says, hey, I've had an experience with this. And, you know, it just further strengthens it, brings new accounts to it, gives us a different side of it that we didn't know about before. I mean, and I admittedly, when I've, you know, first was in journalism and all of these social media outlets started to become more of a thing. And it was, oh, you got to tweet and post and all of these things. I admittedly was like, oh my gosh, this is just, I don't have time for this. This is such a pain. Like, I'm just here to report stories. And I've learned the true value of, you know, these outlets and how they actually can really help strengthen both our audiences as well as our stories, you know, through gathering information and sources.
Yeah, so just looking at it way more as a scalpel than like a blunt mm-hmm. tool. We're using this very strategically. Yeah. And it's not as, it doesn't dominate our lives, I think, nearly as much as we thought it would when I was in J school, for example.
And it helps bring in different age groups and different points mm-hmm. of view, like you said, to steer them to your main story where you want to get them. Yeah, we are talking about the art and science of investigative reporting this afternoon, and we are speaking with journalists Emily Hopkins and Sarah Bowman. We want to remind you that this program is made possible by the generosity of an anonymous donor who supports the Da Vinci Pursuit's mission, which is to create a museum without walls so that artists, scientists, and the community can all come together for unique activities and conversations. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment.
Welcome back. We're talking about the challenges and successes with investigative reporting for print with both Sarah Bowman and Emily Hopkins. You know, it's interesting. I say the word print, and I know I'm in the demographic that still likes to read a newspaper. In fact, I take several newspapers, but there's a reason for that. And I don't think it's that I'm just old school because I'm on Facebook and other things. I do think that the way it helps you structure a story is really powerful. And I wonder if you'd talk about that, because that structuring of it in the written form that way without limits on you know, the amount of words you have those, but you know what I mean? Twitter and other feeds, and it, there's something about that, that medium of doing that. So any thoughts you both have on that? Am I just an old guy thinking that it's okay?
Yeah, I think that the best thing that the newspaper medium gives us, and I think that it is brevity. You can't fit it all in. And I think that that tightens your writing because you know that you have to get a lot of information and in a small space. So you tighten it, you get extreme clarity. There's not a lot of flowery stuff. So I think that's a benefit to it. I think there's definitely a lot of transferable in institutional knowledge of like the inverted pyramid where the most important stuff goes on top for a news story that has transferred to online because you are scrolling just the same way you're reading. You talked about them. My thing, and I do subscribe to the newspaper. I get print, you know, Thursday through Sunday. And yes, I'm a millennial. But my thing is that I want a little package every day of the most important stories. And I think that that's something that hasn't been adopted in all online or like apps. And so if anyone's out there from like corporate who can hear me, like I think the New York Times does it really well. You go into the menu and it says today's paper and you basically kind of have the articles that were in the paper. And I feel like that's a super important thing because otherwise I just feel like there's so many stories that you can read in a single day and so many that don't even make the paper these days because the paper is smaller. So that's what I really like about the paper.
I love it. Yeah, I agree with you, Emily. I think for me, my wife, she loves to get it online, but it's the paper online. So
right,
we'll both read the New York Times, but I'll be reading the Times right across from her reading, and we'll talk back and forth. But I think having that format and having that limitation and also how many things you can actually put in there in general, I think those are important because I think digital media, don't you guys think, when it first came out, I mean, it was people just thought it was like a panacea. I could put everything, and it was just too much.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, there's this idea that online, I mean, you can have a story go on as long as you want and people just, you know, because you can scroll and scroll and scroll. And I think that idea of even if you could do that, is that really the smartest thing? I mean, I know a colleague of mine who is used to work at the Star and now is at USA Today as an investigative reporter. She went to a workshop and she was describing how at this workshop, they went through a story, a long investigative story, you know, several thousand words. And they kind of did this exercise where they had to go through in every single sentence, say, why is that sentence important? What does it bring? What does it add to the story? And because you could easily think that when you have a story that long, hey, if you have a few fluff kind of filler, you know, sentences or paragraphs in there, that's fine. But if anything, it's actually more important in those longer stories because to get people to stick with you for that long, you really want to make sure that you reward them for doing so. You know, they see the value, they're really getting something out of investing that time with you. And so you really want to make sure that you're actually thinking about that. Not, I mean, not that for a short story, you shouldn't care about that. But I mean, especially with those long stories, that every single sentence serves a purpose. And you know, it plays a crucial part of that story.
If you ever read Jane Mayer, who is a New Yorker writer, she's, I've read one of her books in the last couple of years. I love her writing because it feels like every sentence has three footnotes. Because every single, you can feel the reporting dripping from the text because it is so tight. And I'm certainly not there yet, but I, you know, and hopefully get better every single time where I have a story. But you're so right, Sarah. It's like you are asking a reader for their time and investment into these complex investigative pieces, and you need to reward them by not putting any fluff in there and not taking shortcuts with the writing.
I did want to ask you guys, since we're on this topic about readers, how important is it for you to hear from your readers?
I would say incredibly important. I mean, for for me, but I think this goes for all of us. I mean, hearing from our readers, getting feedback from our readers is, we're here to help serve them. We're here to provide this public service to them of giving them information to help them make decisions, to help them live their daily lives and keep them informed. And so, you know, hearing feedback from them helps. I mean, what, obviously in the form of a tip, it's very important, but even just kind of, you know, what they thought about stories or asking questions, that helps us know what is important to them. You know, where are we potentially falling short in our reporting in terms of, you know, where they would like to see more information, or things along those lines. So being able to hear from our readers and not just hear from them, but engage with them, you know, respond to them, have a conversation with them, I find incredibly important.
Yeah, 100%. Just reiterate what Sarah said. I love hearing from readers. I think a lot of times they'll ask a question that they didn't realize I should have been asking because I don't live their life. And honestly, just like, keeps us alive a little bit because we know people are reading and paying attention. And the idea that that you took the time to look up our email and or phone number, give us a call, shoot us a line just to say thank you, or that you liked the story, or that I had a typo in the fourth paragraph. I'm just glad people are paying attention and feel that they feel, you know, that they feel ownership over their paper enough and the news enough to reach out and tell us those things. I think that's great.
Well, we are just about out of time here, unfortunately. Another great conversation. Thank you, Emily and Sarah. We really appreciate your time, and we truly appreciate your writing as well.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I'm so glad to be here. This is really nice. Pick me up in the middle of a very difficult time. So thank you guys for joining us, or letting us join you, I should say.
Wonderful.
Yes, thank you for having us. It was a truly, you know, enjoyable conversation. And Emily and I were saying yesterday ahead of this, you know, how nice it will be to actually get to talk about what we do, you know, because we do enjoy it so much. So it's always fun to get to talk about it with like-minded folks.
And Mark, remind our viewers where they can learn more.
You can find pictures of projects and other guests on our website, DaVinciPursuit.com, where we create museums without walls so artists, scientists, and community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations.
And until our next conversation, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to stay curious.
Stay curious.
Thank you for listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. You can listen to the full show podcast on WICRonline.org, as well as on the DaVinciPursuit.com. Or you can join your hosts, Jill Dittmeyer and Mark Kiesling, here every Saturday at 1 p.m. on a different kind of public radio, 88.7 WICR.